A Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to the deep dive. Today, we are strapping in for a really high-stakes look at leadership under, well, maximum pressure. Our focus is Eric Larson's fantastic historical narrative, The Splendid and the Vile. It's a remarkable book that honestly just thrusts you right into Winston Churchill's war rooms in London during Britain's absolute darkest year.
It really does. It's a moment when, you know, the fate of Western civilization genuinely seemed to be hanging by a thread. The book digs into this profound central question. How exactly did Churchill, and ordinary Britons too, manage to endure and ultimately triumph during the Blitz? Specifically, it covers those crucial 12 months between May 1940 and May 1941, a time when Britain truly stood alone.
Yeah, and that isolation, that standing alone, is exactly why this deep dive is so vital. For you, the listener, the learner, this isn't just, you know, a dry history lesson. It's a masterclass in crisis leadership, in psychological resilience, and frankly, the almost impossible task of keeping up national morale when you were actively being bombed.
Yes.
Every single night. If you want to understand how to lead through just catastrophic uncertainty, well, this is your source material.
Absolutely. And to really get the book, we should probably understand the author a bit first. Eric Larson, he's a celebrated American writer, narrative nonfiction, and a journalist, holds a master's from Columbia. You probably know his blockbusters like The Devil in the White City or In the Garden of Beasts. He's known for just rigorous research.
That's true. I find that his works, they don't read like typical history, do they?
Right.
He manages to combine that incredible historical accuracy with the pacing, the real gripping pace of a novel. Why was accessing those personal details, the intimate diaries, why was that so vital for achieving that feel in The Splendid and the Vile?
Well, it goes further than just humanizing history, although it certainly does that. Larson used those archives to really track the emotional fatigue of the war. For this book, he drew heavily on previously untapped stuff, most notably these intimate day-to-day diaries of Churchill's youngest daughter, Mary Churchill, and also his private secretary, John Colville. This material gives us that essential human dimension, you know, how fear and sheer exhaustion influence strategic decisions, something traditional military histories, well, they rarely capture that.
Okay, so let's unpack the core of the book itself. As you mentioned, it covers just that first year, Churchill's first 12 months as prime minister, May 40 to May 41. The book's core purpose seems to be illuminating how courage, how resilience manifest themselves, not just in the big, grand strategic decisions, but in like the countless small, mundane moments of daily life under constant siege.
Exactly. And the central thesis, it's captured perfectly right there in the title, The Splendid and the Vile. Larson argues that Britain's survival was fundamentally forged by this complex interplay between the splendid, you know, Churchill's defiance, his courage, his world-shaping rhetoric, and the vile. The vile being the visceral terror of the Blitz, the personal loss, the ever-present threat of invasion. Churchill's genius, in Larson's view, was teaching the entire nation the art of being fearless. And he did it through his own very visible example.
And the narrative scope sounds incredibly detailed. It seems to weave together Churchill's public duties, his challenging struggles within his own quite eccentric family. I mean, you mentioned his son, Randolph, and daughter-in-law, Pamela, but also the raw experiences of ordinary Londoners, right?
Oh, absolutely. And the strategic chess match with Hitler, naturally. And then there's that absolutely crucial, very complex, and often, frankly, frustrating relationship with President Roosevelt, FDR.
Much going on.
Yeah, it really was. Let's maybe look chronologically at how this terrifying year unfolded, because the speed and the sheer scale of the crisis were, well, truly overwhelming.
Yeah, okay. Where does it kick off? It truly begins with just utter chaos, doesn't it? Churchill's appointed on May 10th, 1940, literally the same day Hitler invades the Low Countries.
Yeah.
France just collapses almost immediately, leaving the British Expeditionary Force trapped on the coast. And then came Dunkirk. The miracle of Dunkirk.
Right. But what's remarkable, and Larson highlights this, is how Churchill used rhetoric to transform that retreat. I mean, it was a military disaster, really. But instead of letting Dunkirk be remembered solely as a catastrophic failure, he used this almost poetic meter, powerful cadence in his speeches, to turn it into an enduring moral triumph. He established this pattern early on. Brutal honesty mixed with absolutely inspirational defiance, famously offering the nation blood, toil, tears, and sweat.
That's such a key point. That speech didn't minimize the danger, did it? It actually prepared them for the sacrifice to come, which is, you know, vital if you need sustained support through something like that.
Exactly. And then the summer of 1940 became this desperate battle for survival. And the source material, the diaries Larson uses, they reveal the internal political conflict was almost as fierce as the external one. Churchill had to expend significant political capital fighting off really influential cabinet members like Lord Halifax, who were openly advocating for peace negotiations with Hitler. They were arguing Britain just couldn't survive alone.
Wow. So he's fighting Hitler and his own government, in a way.
In a way, yes. And this internal struggle was happening right alongside the technological and industrial battle that Larson calls the Wizard War. This refers to that desperate high-stakes race to develop and deploy technology like radar, and also to optimize the RAFs, a highly decentralized command structure, which turned out to be critical. Churchill decisively used the volatile press baron Lord Beaverbrook to ruthlessly mobilize aircraft production. That desperate push for Spitfires and Hurricanes, it wasn't just the pilots, the planes themselves saved them.
Okay, that makes sense strategically. But the diaries also apparently show Churchill's temper, his political ruthlessness. Was Beaverbrook's mobilization, which was, you know, notoriously aggressive, was that pure genius? Or was it just the necessary brutal exercise of absolute power required to meet that crisis timeline?
Larson presents it as, well, probably both. It was necessary, yes, yeah. Absolutely. But it highlighted Churchill's willingness to prioritize survival above, you know, procedure or personality clashes. That's a key trait in crisis leadership, right? Mm. He tolerated volatility, even difficult personalities, if they delivered results. Which brings us to the critical turning point when Hitler changed his strategy.
Yes. And this is where it gets really dark on the ground for ordinary people. An enraged Hitler ordered the Luftwaffe to switch focus from bombing RAF airfields to mass bombing London itself. That started September 7th, 1940. It was the official start of the Blitz. I have to think about the sheer mental drain of just living in the dark constantly. The book must have details on the little moments, right? Like the absurdity of trying to plan dinner while air raid sirens are blaring outside.
It absolutely does. Larson vividly captures that ground reality. The nightly terror, the total blackouts, people crowding into the underground stations for shelter. And the diary evidence, particularly from Colville, shows Churchill was personally visiting the bomb sites day after day. His presence, you know, the hat, the cigar, it was a powerful, very conscious symbol of defiance. And what's critical, the key takeaway here, is that the German campaign completely failed to break civilian morale. If anything, it strengthened British resolve because people felt unified in their suffering.
Incredible resilience.
Yeah.
But that resolve was tested to the absolute extreme, wasn't it? Because the narrative then enters what Larson calls the winter of discontent. Mm-hmm. This sounds like the psychological low point. The bombing intensified, you had devastating raids like the one on Coventry, and crucially, American support was still deeply uncertain.
Yes, and this brings us to that absolutely pivotal relationship with FDR. Larson details how Churchill's persistence, combined with strategic charm, let's say, finally led to the passage of the Lend-Lease Act. Now, this wasn't just a material win getting supplies. It was a demonstration of how a leader can leverage personal capital, their relationships, to secure vital external resources when your internal ones are just exhausted. The act provided the necessary tools for Britain's long-term survival, and the entire solitary struggle essentially concludes, rather dramatically, on May 10th, 1941. It followed a massive final raid and coincided, just bizarrely, with the parachuting of Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy, into Scotland. A truly surreal end.
Wow, what a strange bookend to that year. Just captures the chaos, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but if we sort of pull away from the gripping historical drama for a second, what single, maybe counterintuitive insight does Larson offer about endurance that still applies to crisis leadership today?
For me, the most powerful takeaway is about leadership through communication. Churchill's rhetoric, his mastery of language, it literally shaped public understanding. It transformed what looked like, and often were, military defeats into sources of moral strength. We talked about Dunkirk. He used poetic meter, almost biblical cadence, to turn that retreat into an enduring moral triumph. So the lesson is, leaders must not just act strategically, they have to frame events meaningfully for people, provide the why.
That brings up a fascinating point, though, the power of personal example. You said Churchill shared the risks. He was frequently on the ground visiting bomb sites. But the diaries also show him being deeply exhausted, flawed human. So was his personal example truly about sharing the risk, or was it also perhaps a calculated act of strategic visibility, knowing the press and the diarist would record his visits?
I think Larson suggests it was probably both. And maybe that's the point. Authentic leadership requires embodying the qualities you ask of your followers. He clearly felt the emotion. He was genuinely moved by the casualties, the diaries show that. But he also understood that the visibility of his cigar and his hat amidst the rubble was a critical tool of political communication. He balanced strategic intelligence with emotional intelligence. They worked together.
Okay. And then the third theme you touched on, the sheer resilience of the human spirit. Larson demonstrates this resilience came from, yes, shared purpose, but also, perhaps most surprisingly, from the simple decision to maintain dignity and routine despite the constant fear.
Yeah, the persistence of the ordinary.
Right. Now, you mentioned Churchill mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. That's a great line itself. Let's look at a few key phrases or ideas that really define this year, according to the book.
Well, the book's title itself, The Splendid and the Vile, that just captures the emotional core, doesn't it? Imagine, as Larson describes, a formal dinner being held deep in the war rooms while bombs are literally falling outside. That nobility of carrying on coexisting with the sheer horror of warfare, that's the essence.
Yeah, it captures that duality perfectly. And of course, there's that foundational statement, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Larson really emphasizes that acknowledging the inevitable hardship, doing it honestly right up front, built immediate credibility. By facing reality head on, he prepared the nation for the sacrifice needed. It was vital for sustained support.
Absolutely. And tying back to that idea of resilience we just mentioned, the book highlights the notion that the persistence of ordinary life, you know, the milkman completing his round through the rubble, the office workday somehow continuing, that was in itself an act of profound, if subtle, defiance. The ultimate failure of the Blitz wasn't just military, it was its inability to destroy the mundane fabric of life. Normalcy itself became resistance.
That's a powerful thought. So, okay, let's make this practical. If you, our listener, are managing a crisis, maybe running an organization through a period of extreme uncertainty, what can you actually apply from this single year of British resilience?
Well, for crisis communication, I think you can adopt Churchill's framework. Be brutally honest about the challenge, yes, but provide a clear moral vision, the why, for enduring the hardship. And crucially, remain personally visible. Visibility isn't just about showing up. It embodies resilience for your entire team or constituency. People need to see the leader sharing the burden.
Mm-hmm. And we also see that crucial lesson in, let's call it strategic diplomacy, maybe. When your own internal resources are completely exhausted, you have to be willing to leverage your personal capital, your relationships, like Churchill did with his charm and sheer persistence with FDR, to secure those essential external resources. Don't isolate, strategically align with partners, and for personal resilience. Maybe the lesson is simpler. Establish those daily routines. They provide essential stability during deeply uncertain times, just like they did for Londoners during the Blitz.
Definitely. I think the most lasting insight, for me anyway, is that success during a massive crisis requires balancing that strategic intelligence, the ruthless prioritization, the technological battle with emotional intelligence, that deep understanding of human psychology, of morale. The two were completely inseparable in 1940. You couldn't have one without the other.
Yeah, absolutely. What was surprising for me reading about this was realizing just how fragile it all was, that the survival of Western democracy wasn't abstract or somehow guaranteed. It was a human victory, won by individuals who were often, as the diaries show, exhausted, frightened, flawed, yet somehow extraordinarily courageous when it mattered most. The way Larson presents it, it really does transform history into this gripping, personal, psychological thriller. It just demonstrates the incredible power of both leadership and language working together.
Couldn't agree more. A stunning portrayal of a pivotal moment.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acatra Foundation.